is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, I have a Bernie bear. It says, I love brunch with Bernie. Anyway, Rand Paul. Well, there's Rand Paul. There was Bernie on Meet the Press, as predicted. You have Bernie and two Republicans. And did Chuck Todd take the opportunity to say, okay, there are some issues where the Republican Party, including you two candidates or you two guys, and the Democratic Party, including Senator Sanders, or at least large portions of both parties, disagree. So let's have a conversation about whether we should cut Social Security or expand it. Should we raise the eligibility age or lower it? Should we do something about the $700 million that was just, was it million or billion? Million. $700 million that was just cut out of Medicare in order to pay for the TPP? Let's have a conversation about the TPP for that matter. Well, I'm sorry, that's not allowed on NBC. Let's have a conversation about net neutrality. Oh, I'm sorry, that's not allowed on NBC either. Or any, and it's not just NBC. This is like, you know, no media. Well, let's have a conversation about boondoggle military stuff. Oh, no. We take billions of dollars from hundreds of millions of dollars in advertising dollars from the defense contractors. Well, let's have a conversation about oil, you know, and fossil fuels and our dependence on fossil. Oh, no, you can't do that. Sorry, we can't talk about that here on Meet the Press because our network takes lots and lots of money from the fracking industry. And you look at these ads, you know, oh, America's clean energy. Isn't this wonderful? Look at this, you know, attractive woman who's talking about, you know, the oil's drilling in the ground, all this. And it seems so nice and fun, you know, and sparkly. But do you want to buy an oil well? I mean, you see the ads for McDonnell Douglas. You want to buy a fighter jet? These ads are there, in my opinion, to prevent the networks to cause exactly what happened yesterday on Meet the Press, which is, let's ask Bernie two questions, which is what was predicted, by the way, you know, on our message board over at Democratic Underground, everything else. In fact, you know, we probably should have turned it into a drinking game, except that Bernie wasn't on that long, which is every time Chuck Todd mentions the word Hillary while he's talking to or about Bernie. And every time he talks about rape, right? I mean, which is nuts. So, anyhow, there's that. But the other thing that I think is fascinating that's going on right now, you probably noticed the Senate was back in session yesterday. Mitch McConnell was trying to get the Patriot Act renewed. And or the USA Freedom Act. I mean, it's reaching the point, I think, where they'll take pretty much anything in order to keep spying on us. What happened to the land of the free and the home of the brave? I mean, Rand Paul is taking this head on. Now, his motives may not be pure. Certainly, his colleagues are suggesting out loud and in open that his motives are not pure. But I think that he's right. And, I mean, this is from part of his speech on the floor of the Senate. He said, people here in this town think I'm making a huge mistake. Some of them, I think, secretly want there to be an attack on the United States so they can blame it on me. Do we blame the police chief for the attack of the Boston bombers? The thing is, there can be attacks even if we use the Constitution. And there have been attacks while we've been collecting our bulk data. So the ones who say when an attack occurs, it's going to be all your fault, meaning my fault, Rand Paul, are any of them willing to accept the blame? We have bulk collection now. Are you willing to accept the blame for the Boston bombing or the recent shooting in Garland, Texas? No, but they'll be the first to point fingers and say, oh, yeah, it's all your fault. So the Senate voted 77-17 to move forward the USA Freedom Act, which is a, you know, just a scaled back version of Section 215 of the Patriot Act, slightly scaled back with all kinds of workarounds. And by the way, the Department of Justice already has workarounds. It's not like they just shut everything off last night at midnight. Victoria Jones in her news summary for the day is reporting the Justice Department may invoke a so-called grandfather clause to keep using those powers for investigations that had started before June 1st. Apparently, if you start an investigation before June 1st, when the law expires, you can continue to do it. Well, if they're collecting all of our phone numbers, and apparently they are, all of our phone activity, among other things, then it's not like, hey, we were investigating this one guy, this biker down in Waco. We got it, so we can continue watching him. No. A visibly angry McConnell, writes Victoria Jones, made a last-gasp attempt. McConnell gave a stern speech, sometimes staring at Rand Paul, saying that letting the provisions expire would, I'm quoting McConnell, would mean disarming completely and arbitrarily based on a campaign of disinformation. So to point out that the U.S. Second Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled that the way that we're using the Patriot Act's Section 215 is against the law is apparently a campaign of disinformation. Rand Paul got up and said, it concerns me that the president who supports bulk data collection has been performing it illegally for 6 years is supporting this bill. He's talking about the USA Freedom Bill. It's hard for me to have trust in the people we're giving power to. And this is where it gets really gnarly. In a closed-door meeting, Victoria writes, Sunday, Republicans lashed out at Senator Rand Paul's defiant stance. Senator Dan Coats even accused Rand Paul of lying to raise money for his presidential campaign. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. On Thursday or Friday, on Politico, there was an article that got pretty much no mention, and this whole thing gets no mention in the large, quote, mainstream media. And the reason why is because the mainstream media, when a politician gets a billionaire and thus has, hundreds of millions of dollars to spend, they spend it on advertising in the media. So the media is not really all that excited about reporting on these things. But the piece in Politico pointed out that, Marco Rubio has had a billionaire since before he ran for the Senate. He has had a billionaire supporter all along. So he's a viable presidential candidate on the Republican side. To be a viable candidate as a Republican, you have to have a billionaire. Scott Walker clearly has, he's got the Koch brothers. We know that long history. And in fact, he's like leading the polls in Iowa. I'm curious if you are watching or listening in Iowa, have you been seeing ads for Scott Walker paid for by one of many super PACs? I'm wondering why Scott Walker is up in Iowa. Is it because the Koch brothers are throwing money at him, via all these shadowy groups? Or is it that he's doing good retail politics and shaking hands and all that? I don't know. But anyhow, so the Politico says Rand Paul's got a problem. He might not even be a viable candidate because he doesn't have a billionaire. So here's what Senator McCain said yesterday in this closed-door meeting. He says, I know what this is about. I think it's very clear. This is to some degree a fundraising exercise. He obviously has a higher priority for his fundraising and political ambitions than for the security of the nation. The only problem was that Rand Paul was not in the room when that meeting happened. Paul skipped the hour-long meeting, which infuriated his colleagues even more. So, I want to get into this. Martin O'Malley has jumped into the race. It's a very interesting metric over at Democratic Underground having to do with how money is being raised. Bernie showed up in Minneapolis over the weekend, and it was like, they had to keep getting larger and larger rooms, and even then they couldn't accommodate everybody. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Monday. There's just a pile of stuff, and we'll be picking up your phone calls here, too. And welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, the headline over on Drudge right now, free to chat without NSA tracking, at least for now. Right. And of course the normal and expected gratuitous Clinton bashing is going on. By the way, see this bear? I love brunch with Bernie. I'll be telling you about that at the bottom of the hour, because it's he's got a pin. I love Brunch with Bernie. I'll tell you about it at the bottom of the hour. So pick up a couple of calls here. Jill in Princeton, Minnesota. Hey, Jill. Thanks for watching Free Speech
TV. Hi, Tom.
Hey.
Hi, Tom. Thank you, Tom and crew. Well, I don't have a question today. Just a little bit to say.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for the information you gave last week regarding presidential primaries, caucuses, and their respective dates.
Sure. So
gigantic information for the people to help Senator Sanders win. So thank you, Danielle, Shano, and crew.
Yeah.
Bernie delivered in Minnesota on Sunday morning. Over 3,000 people came.
Right.
And our morning news, both via radio and television, announced Bernie coming and covered the political revolution afterwards. So
that's great.
Bravo, Minnesota. Bravo, yeah. And please, Minnesotans, don't be dissed that Bernie couldn't stay long after, because he had a great opportunity for live coverage on NBC's Meet the Press. I don't think that was in the makings when he planned on going to Iowa and Minnesota, and I think he kind of had to escape. But our political revolution needs Bernie Sanders to reach everyone, so that was wonderful. And he handled himself perfectly on MSNBC.
Yeah, I say what's unfortunate is that, you know, Chuck Todd, the moderator, did absolutely nothing about the issues, to the best that I can tell. You know.
Oh yeah, but Bernie brought it right around.
I know, and then they dropped it.
Well, at least he got the coverage. That's a start, and I think that's what we've been saying. You know, so don't forget, my Minnesotans, that Bernie vowed that his next visit will have, well, enough bagels and seats and coffee for everyone. So
hopefully.
We're going to hold him to it.
Well, we'll see. I mean, the crowd might be twice as large. It's like,
well,
I think their minds are blown.
Yeah, twice as large, yeah.
I have not talked with anybody on Bernie's campaign. In fact, I'm not even sure who's running his campaign. I think it might be a fellow who was, you know, very close and very high up in his staff. But I'm not sure, so I'm not going to throw any names out. I don't regularly converse with these guys, you know, other than just Fridays on this radio show. And so I've got no inside information. But everything that I'm hearing from secondary sources is that the people running the Bernie Sanders campaign are completely blown away by the response to his campaign, by how many people are showing up, how enthusiastic they are, how much money they're throwing in. They put up their store over at BernieSanders.com over the weekend, and so many people went to the store to try to buy things that have browned out the server. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing. Jill, thanks for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in Minnesota. We will be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. So Rand Paul, I mean, you know, it's entirely possible that Rand Paul actually believes what he's doing and is using it to raise money. In fact, I'd say that's probably a certainty. And I wonder if he was in the pocket, you know, I mean, this Politico article talked about how Rand Paul had gone to the Koch brothers on bended knee. You know, he went to one of their events. But Scott Walker was there, apparently, and, you know, he's probably going to get all their money. They certainly have been. He's been their guy, right? You know, through Minnesota or through Wisconsin and all this. They talked about how he went to Shelley Adelson and bowed before him, kissed his ring. Sorry, no dice. Number of other billionaires. I think Peter Thiel. I forget. Anyway, they said, you know, you know, is he doing this? And what's going to happen? I think, frankly, this USA Freedom Act is going to pass because it's got the support of the White House and the Republican senior majority. Today, Lindsey Graham also announced his candidacy outside what was once a pool hall run by his parents. Yes, We're supposed to not think about Lindsey Graham in terms of his warmongering for Afghanistan and Iraq and his warmongering for Iran and his warmongering for Syria and Libya and any other war. Lindsey Graham never saw a war he didn't like, probably because he never fought in one. He was in the military. He was a JAG officer. He was a lawyer in the military. But, you know, to the best of my knowledge, he's never seen combat or been near it. And Governor Martin O'Malley, this was interesting. He took a swipe at Hillary Clinton. And yet this stuff seems to be rolling off her back. I mean, she's still running at 56% overall approval ratings or, you know, I would vote for her among Democrats. Bernie has gone from 1% to 7% to 15% nationwide in just 2 weeks, which is pretty astonishing. But he hasn't been taking that out of Hillary. He has been taking that out of the, I'm not in favor of Hillary, but I'm not sure, right? Which might be the Elizabeth Warren crowd. It might just be, I mean, who knows? Who knows? But here's what Martin O'Malley said. He said, when you have somebody that's a CEO, actually, do we have the clip of this? Yeah, here's Martin O'Malley.
We need to prosecute cheats. We need to reinstate Glass-Steagall. And if a bank is too big to fail without wrecking our nation's economy, then we need to break it up before it breaks us again.
Yeah, and then this, and then he said,
the CEO of Goldman Sachs, let his employees know that he'd be just fine with either Bush or Clinton. I bet he would. Well, I've got news for the bullies of Wall Street. The presidency is not a crown to be passed back and forth by you between two royal families.
Right. So, and then, you know, Face the Nation, they had Jeb Bush and you know, that sort of thing. There's a bunch of so many things I wanted to talk about today. Police shootings. Killedbypolice.net, you know, we're up over, I think we're over 400 people now at this year. I haven't opened the website today. I was looking at it last Friday. The number of black people, the BBC and the Washington Post both reported on this. Data collected, Victoria Jones writing, data collected by the Washington Post suggests that the number of people shot by U.S. police is twice as high as official figures claim. Twice as high. We got 17,000 police departments across the country. They're killing people at the rate of, well, last Friday, 5 people. On Thursday, it was 4 people. It found a homicide rate of almost 2.6 per day so far this year, more than double the official FBI number of 1.1. Black people were killed at 3 times the rate of whites or other minorities when adjusted for local population. 1 in 6 black people who were killed was either unarmed or, like in the case of Tamir Rice, carrying a toy gun. It's amazing. And finally, I just wanted to Tahira Ahmed, who is the director of interfaith engagement and the associate chaplain at Northwestern University. She's Muslim and she's an associate chaplain at a university. Was on a United Airlines flight, and apparently United is trying to clean this up. She asked for a Diet Coke. The flight attendant opened it and handed it to her, and she was wearing hijab, by the way. She was clearly Muslim. The flight attendant opened it and handed it to her. She gave it back to the flight attendant and said, "Can you give me an unopened can, please? You know, for sanitary reasons, my religion requires that I be the one who handle the part where my, you know, where I'm going to be drinking this stuff." And the flight attendant said, "Sorry, I can't give you an unopened can, so no Diet Coke for you." Then the next guy that the flight attendant went to wanted a beer, and she handed him an unopened can of beer. So Ahmad said, "You know, what's with this?" And so the flight attendant reaches over and opens the guy's beer. So then she turns to the other passengers around her and says, "Am I being discriminated against?" And the only person who answered, this is such a sad commentary on America right now. In fact, I want to get into this after the break and we can pick up your phone calls too. The only person who answered was a man who said, "You Muslim, you need to shut the F up." Yes, you know you would use it as a weapon, so shut the F up.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
United has apologized, and I'm sure that, you know, this is, you know, the airlines will be cleaning this up, but this is the state. I mean, you saw what happened in Arizona over the weekend. Ah, yes, time for our Borowitz Alert, courtesy of Andy Borowitz, writing for The New Yorker. The National Security Agency, he writes, is compensating for the expiration of its power to collect the American people's personal information by logging onto Facebook. The agency confirmed on Monday. The director of the NSA, Admiral Michael S. Rogers, said that when parts of the Patriot Act expired at midnight on Sunday, intelligence analysts immediately stopped collecting mountains of phone metadata and started reading billions of Facebook updates instead. Rogers says, from a surveillance point of view, the transition has been seamless. While the NSA has monitored Facebook in the past, it is now spending 24 hours a day sifting through billions of baby pictures, pet videos, and photographs of recently enjoyed food to detect possible threats to the United States. Rogers said, those status updates contain everything we want to know, in many cases a good deal more than we want to know. Citing one possible downside of the new surveillance regime, Rogers said that some NSA analysts who now do nothing but monitor Facebook all day report feelings of worthlessness and despair. I remind them, he said, that they're doing this for America. The NSA's new strategy of monitoring Facebook drew a sharp rebuke from Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who told reporters, I just blocked them. Right. In fact, in actual point of fact, they haven't stopped because of this grandfather clause, apparently, according to the news that I'm reading. They haven't stopped because this grandfather clause says if you've already started an investigation, you can keep on doing it. So, anyhow, we'll see. We'll see, you know, where it all goes. Apropos of, I just wanted to close this loop, and then we'll pick up your phone calls. Apropos of this Muslim woman wearing a hijab, if I'm saying that right, on this United flight, who was denied an unopened can of Diet Coke so that she could open it herself, according, you know, Orthodox Jews are very similar in this regard. And, you know, basically it's like cleanliness laws, you know, as part of their religion. And what astonished me wasn't so much, you know, a flight attendant who was, well, the flight attendant being a bigot, that, or, was she, here's the question, was the flight attendant a bigot or was she just terrified? Was she frightened? I mean, is this, and I think it's probably the latter, although that leads to bigotry. Because we have now, for 13 years, been, you know, beaten over the head, 14 years, repeatedly, with the idea that Muslims are the new, you know, fill in the blank. They're the new enemy. And Muslims are not the new enemy. I mean, even worldwide, only 18% of worldwide Muslims are even Arab. And Arabs aren't the new enemy. I mean, George Bush did his best to try to make them the new enemy. He certainly upset a lot of them. He you know, helped create ISIS and all that other kind of stuff. But this was our stupidity. And then over the weekend in Arizona, you had this idiot. Let me find his name. Maybe I shouldn't even. I don't know. But over the weekend, this so-called rally for free speech. The guy's name, John Ritzheimer. He was wearing F Islam, only the F was all four letters spelled out, T-shirts. And he had a Draw Muhammad cartoon contest. So, you know, the fearful bigots. You know, it used to be, look out, black men are going to rape your wives and your daughters. I mean, that was the whole that was the whole thing behind the war on drugs in the 1920s and 30s. Reefer madness. And to some extent continues to this day. And now it's, you know, look out, she's wearing a hijab. Maybe she actually wants to use that can of Coke to take down the airplane. Really? Anyhow, he's wearing, this guy in Phoenix, he's wearing these F Islam T-shirts. The good news is that there was a crowd that was as large, maybe larger, of people who were. I saw one picture where there was one of the guys holding a sign that said something like, you know, screw Islam or send Obama back to Kenya. I mean, you know, all the crazies were there, right? I mean, it's the normal bunch of crazies. The people, the Fox so-called news watchers, people who listen to hate radio. Because they've got to distract you from, you know, the powers that be, the big media networks and the billionaires like Rupert Murdoch. They've got to distract you from how they're robbing us all blind. And when people are being robbed blind, when middle class people are seeing their lives destroyed, what do? They look around and they say, okay, who's destroying my life? And the media won't tell them. Oh, it's the billionaires and it's the big transnational corporations. Amazing piece in the Boston Globe this weekend. Last week, I was talking about stock buybacks. We'll get into that another time. But the point is, we're being robbed. We have been being robbed ever since the 1980s. I mean, this is what Reaganism was all about, was robbing the middle class to make the rich richer. And the middle class has shrunk, and the working poor has dramatically increased. So anyhow, this guy holds his so-called rally. And, the picture I was telling you about, there was this one guy with his, send Obama back to Kenya or, you know, whatever. And the guy next to him was holding a sign that pointed to the man next to him that said, ignorant bigot. You know, it's like, yeah. So anyhow, when the organizer of this thing was asked if he had anything to say to Anderson Cooper, he held up his middle finger and said, yeah, F you. Only he actually said the word. Let me just wrap this up with a quote from Molly Ivins that was posted today on Democratic Underground and the late, great Molly Ivins, that is so solid. She said, when politicians start talking about large groups of their fellow Americans as enemies, it's time for a quiet stir of alertness. Polarizing people is a good way to win an election, but it's also a good way to wreck a country. And I would submit to you, that's going to be the basis of Lindsey Graham's campaign. You just watch. Frank in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hey, Frank, what's up?
I was at the Bernie Sanders rally in Minneapolis yesterday, and it was a great event. There were a lot of young people, and they were very enthusiastic.
I understand there was like 3,000 people that they had originally planned for a couple of hundred, and they had to change rooms, and then they changed again to an auditorium, and even that was overflowing.
Yep, they had people standing outside listening to speakers outside to what he had to say.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, then, you know, in Iowa, 50 people show up for a Rick Santorum event, 110 people show up for a Rand Paul event, and yet the media... You know, the wall-to-wall coverage of the media is, you know, Rand Paul, Jeb Bush, you know, Rick Santorum, but Bernie is drawing these huge crowds. I mean, it's just amazing. Frank, thanks for sharing your story with us. That's great, great to know. Joyce in Deer Lodge, Montana. Hey, Joyce, what's up?
Hey, nice to get through to you, Tom, and good afternoon to you, I guess.
Thank you.
I'm still in morning. I just talked to a very good friend outside Rochester, New York. He's a retired electrician.
Mm-hmm.
And they know I always get back to politics. And so I said, well, who are you liking this year? And he said, Bernie Sanders. I said, awesome. And do you know Bernie is the only one, the politician, he takes no money from big money?
Right.
He takes small donations? He said, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, the only large organizations that support Bernie are a few of the unions, and unions are democratic institutions, which means it's really the union members. They have to vote on how their money is used, so it's really the individual union members who are supporting Bernie.
Well, you know, I watch Chuck Todd, all these programs every Sunday morning, and I agree with you that. They're not going to give Bernie any airtime when it comes to the biggest problem facing this country, or one of them at least, is big money in politics.
Yeah, and I think they're scared to death that Bernie will bring up big media and media consolidation, too. I mean, there's a bunch of issues that you may not discuss on television in the United States right now that are destroying our democracy, that Bernie talks about regularly on this program and in any other venue whenever he has a chance. But Chuck Todd had to be very, very careful to keep Bernie in a very, very small box.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Koch Industries is one of the sponsors of Meet the Press.
Really? I didn't, you know, amazing. I didn't see
it goes very quickly.
Yeah, I didn't see the show in real time. I was on airplanes, you know, over
and
the weekend.
So does PBS.
Yeah.
They also have contributors that are Koch Industries.
Yeah, well, Meet the Press is NBC,
I know that, but I watch.
Oh, I see. So both, in other words, yeah, I'm sure, you know, Koch Industries is supporting all three networks right now. They're running a lot of advertising, and I don't think that advertising is to try to clean up their image. I think that advertising is to try to say to the networks, don't pick on us, or you will lose this money.
yeah. You know what? This is one of your favorite sayings. You're spot on, Tom.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Joyce. Joyce, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. And we just hit a break. Thank you for the call. Thanks for watching us there in Deer Lodge, Montana. We will be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls and my rants, the news of the day. Is Rand Paul doing something fundamentally good for America? I think so. And welcome back, Dylan in Las Vegas. Oops. My index finger is, I injured it over the weekend. I was in Albuquerque and I closed a door on it, car door. And so I had to do things with my middle finger. Or ring finger, and it's not always working the way it should. Dylan in Las Vegas, New Mexico. Hey, Dylan, thanks for watching Free Speech on DirecTV. What's up? Dylan? Dylan is on line 9. Apparently Jay did not come in and fix our... Who knows? Okay. Dylan, I'm going to put you on hold. We'll see what happens here. Let's try line 10 and see what happens. Larry in Pulaski, Pennsylvania. Larry, can you hear me?
Yes, Tom.
Great. Thanks for watching Free Speech. Yep.
Hey, by the way, I consider you part of this family. I figure the United States government is my family. That's why we need you as a family member to save this country. I want you to do the same thing that Grover did for the rich. I want you to have a pledge, you and the American people, so I can take it to my politicians. And I can show them this pledge not to cut Social Security, Medicare, put a cap, take the cap off of Social Security, minimum wage, union. I want all this stuff. And I want to, when I see my representative running for Congress or I say, I want you to, well, Grover did. Here, sign this pledge that you won't cut any of this stuff.
Right.
And everything Grover does cuts all this stuff.
You're talking Grover Norquist, the no more taxes pledge guy,
yeah.
the multimillionaire K Street lobbyist.
You hear what I'm saying, Tom?
I do. I absolutely do, and I think you are absolutely right. Larry, thanks a lot for the call. I think there should be one. Whether I should do it or not, I don't know, but because the thing about Grover Norquist, he can go to a politician and say, sign this pledge, because he's a K Street lobbyist. In other words, sign this pledge, and I'll make sure that one of my clients gives you $10,000. I can't do that. Dylan in Las Vegas. Let's try it again, Dylan.
Hi.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
And I can, and you're still on line 9, so must have been a hiccup. What's up?
I just wanted to bring up a fear I have about Bernie Sanders' campaign.
Mm-hmm.
If he doesn't get the Democratic nomination.
Right.
I'm worried that his campaign would, if he runs as an independent, will split the Democratic voter base.
He won't do that.
And which would give the
Republicans
a chance.
You're right, but he's not going to do that, Dylan. Dylan, he's been saying from day one, he's running as a Democrat in the Democratic primary. If he loses the primary, that's it. He's going back to being a senator. End of discussion.
Oh, he said that. Oh,
yeah, he's said it 100 times, over and over and over again. He will not play the role of a spoiler. In fact, if he loses the Democratic nomination to Hillary Clinton or anybody else, he will enthusiastically support that candidate. He speaks very well of Hillary.
That's good. Obviously, Bernie Sanders is the right moral candidate. Like, if you go by the issues, I love Bernie Sanders.
And he's been absolutely consistent for over 30 years. He is solid on these issues. He understands these issues. He has appealed to older people because of his concerns about Social Security and Medicare. He has appealed to veterans. He was head of the Veterans Affairs Committee in the U.S. Senate and pushed through enormous help for U.S. veterans. He has appealed with young people. He's calling for free college for everybody. I mean, this right across the board. Women. He has fought for the rights of women his entire career. He was a founding member of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He's been involved in civil rights his whole life. He was here in D.C. in '63 with Martin Luther King. I mean, he's the guy, in my opinion. Talk Media for the sane among us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. What do we do? I just to wrap up my story about the whole anti-Muslim thing over the weekend and whatnot. What do we do to wake up America to the fact that this Islamophobia that's going on in the United States is just a new form of bigotry. It's not new. I mean, it's the new acceptable form of bigotry. And we should be shaming these bigots. I mean, what do we do about this? It's amazing. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Corky.
How are you doing today? I'm sorry to see your finger in such bitch.
It's okay. I don't think it's broken. I think it's just swollen about 30%, and it hurts. So I think I cracked the bone because there's a little bit of bruising.
I think the Republicans created their boogeyman that they've been looking for. They tried with the Soviets. They tried with the Taliban. They tried with everybody.
Right.
But they finally got this ISIS and the headscarves as the big boogeyman that's going to get the money that they need for the military corporate complex.
Yeah.
They've been trying for 6 years to find this boogeyman.
Yeah.
And if we the people fall for this, we are dumber than a box of rocks.
Dumber than a box of rocks. No, actually, if we fall for it, Corky, we are pretty much like every other society that has been demagogued by fearmongers who use that for political gain. Whether it was Mussolini going against communists and gypsies, whether it was Hitler going against Jews and gays and communists and trade unionists, whether it was, fill in the blank, right? Early WASP American, the founding fathers going against the Indians, those savages, that justifies killing them. Justifying slavery in this country. I mean, whatever it is, it's like, I think it's built into humans that we are vulnerable to being afraid. And the tragedy is that there's these Lindsey Grahams out there, or much of the Republican field, in fact, who find fear an effective way to be politically active. And I think it's a crime.
They're trying to get us to give up our money. I mean, all that you say is true.
Yeah.
But with military corporate complex, all it is lobbyists and get me money.
Yeah, it's a transfer of money from the middle class to the wealthy, and a large chunk of those wealthy are in the military-industrial complex. I mean, it's almost half the U.S. budget. You're absolutely right, Corky. You're absolutely right. Thanks for the call. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, you were at the Bernie rally?
Yeah, I just wanted to say I heard from one of the organizers that they counted 3,700 and some odd people. And that there were, more that, were out, on the sidewalk because they have an outdoor amphitheater and they had speakers set up. But the energy was just absolutely, just blew me away. People were giving standing ovations for so many of the things that he was saying. And then just standing in line, I knew it was going to be quite crowded, so I got there very early, and I was lucky to actually get seated And just speaking with people, there were people from Wisconsin. I spoke with a school teacher from Wisconsin who had a lot of interesting things to say about Walker. And then I spoke with an older couple. They must have been in their 70s, and they lived in a fairly affluent exurb called Victoria, which is on Lake Minnetonka, where a lot of wealthy Republicans live.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they, she said that her husband gets a lot of ribbing from his golf buddies because he's like the only Democrat and, you know, supporting Bernie Sanders. He really kind of,
right.
you know, a lot from them. But it was really an interesting cross-section of people. It wasn't just the liberal core of one of the most liberal cities in the country. I mean, I guess I could say that because Keith Ellison, he's, you know, head of the, or I guess co-chair of the Progressive Democrats in the Congress, and, you know, he gets like almost 70%, so it's almost like a shoe-in, you know. Mm-hmm. But the thing was, it was, there was just so much energy, and, you know, if this is any example of how it's going to go, it's like, you know, I think it's really going to, you know, do very, very well. I mean, his campaign is going to do extremely
well. Here's the thing, John. Can you imagine if 3,700 people had shown up for a Scott Walker event or for a John Kasich event or for a Donald Trump event or for, I mean, name any, your most obscure Republican candidate or even a Jeb Bush event. You know, to the best of my knowledge, none of these guys have drawn this kind of a crowd, and I may well be wrong, but wouldn't the press be all over it? I have seen absolutely no coverage of the size of the response that Bernie got in Minnesota, and for that matter, the same thing happened in Wisconsin last week, or excuse me, in Iowa last week. He overwhelmed the capacity of the hall twice, and it was not reported in the media.
Right, and this is, you know, I mean, I do think we live in really dark times as far as, you know, free speech, as far as getting, you know, that's the fourth estate of our country to be able to get this kind of recognition so that we can all make proper choices, and this needs to be hammered. I know you can talk about it every day because it's very, very important, but I at least got to talk to different people and ask them. You know, we were talking in line about what media sources they, you know, get. And none of them have heard of you or, well, not none of them. Some did and a few didn't. But they depend on, say, like Minnesota Public Radio. And I said, well, do you know that I just rattled off certain issues that they just didn't cover or that they buried in the back page of their website.
Right.
And I said, what do you think of that? You know, why don't you listen to Free Speech TV, Amy Goodman, Democracy Now, you know, independent media. That's what
right.
you need to listen to. Right. And so I hope that made an impact, the couple from Victoria.
Well, and, you know, we used to even have just local media. I mean, there's still some local media. In Minneapolis, for example, there's a great local radio station, KTNF. But they're few and far between.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. On the line with us, Horace Cooper, attorney, senior fellow with the National Center for Public Policy Research, nationalcenter.org, the website for that conservative think tank. Horace, welcome back.
Thanks for having the program today.
My pleasure. We are looking at levels of income inequality, disparity between the massive amounts of money that are being accumulated by a small number of very wealthy people and you know, increasing poverty and the destruction of the middle class that we haven't seen in the United States since 1929, and that did not turn out all that well. So what's your solution to that?
Well, I'm not concerned at all, actually, about the disparity. I'm concerned more about access to opportunity and income growth that could affect people broadly.
But that disparity diminishes that access.
No, that's not true. I wouldn't care if we were a nation with hundreds of trillionaires, as long as what we saw were middle class people and working class people seeing that they had growth opportunities. And the truth is, the presence of government has really crowded out the ability of the broad middle class.
That's nonsense.
No,
that's absolute nonsense.
That's exactly what we see.
No, that's absolute nonsense for us. What is happening right now is you've got corporations that are using hundreds of billions of dollars. I'm guessing you probably saw this. Boston Globe did a great piece on this over the weekend, where these corporations are buying back their stock in order to so that, you know, because the senior executives are being compensated with stock options, so that the senior executives can walk away with multi-hundred million dollar compensation packages, and it adds absolutely no value to the company. In fact, one of the examples they gave, Cisco, they laid off 6,000 people at the same time they were showing a huge profit, and then they did this giant stock buyback with some of the $50 billion that they're sitting on, in order to be able to just transfer billions of dollars to their senior executives. This is the new economic model, and it sucks.
Okay, Tom, well, that's envy masquerading as economics. The issue is, what impact on middle-class incomes did this decision to reallocate stock value from individuals to the company's bottom line? What we want to see, and what would make sense, is that we are encouraging an environment where individuals with great ideas see opportunity to come out into the marketplace and get a healthy return.
And they can't borrow the money to start a business for us. Right now, the banks are sitting on...
They can't borrow the money to start a business, and they also live in abject fear that if they decide to take the risk, the consequences of just not success, but the consequences of just making it to survive for a period can be consequential. There's OSHA, there's EPA, there's the IRS auditing effort. Look at what happened with Gibson Guitars. You don't know that one of your producers has a material that goes into your guitars until after you get raided. Think of what daunting aspects that has for just a small guy.
I want the occupational. Horace, my recollection is it's 50,000. Maybe it's 30,000 Americans every year are severely injured or killed on the job. I want the Occupational Safety and Health Administration to be looking out for people. Otherwise, we would still be poisoning people with lead and mercury and God only knows what all. I want the USDA to be inspecting the food. In fact, they're inspecting so little of it that we're being poisoned by food from overseas because Republicans and conservatives like yourself constantly want to defund these agencies. There is a role for government. The profit motive does not solve all problems. The profit motive is the most corrupting thing there is.
The role of government may be relevant, may be important, may be crucial, but it doesn't come cost-free. And we have built up a very, very elaborate superstructure that has this advantage. If you already have billions, it is easier to manipulate this government structure process to get more billions. What isn't easy to do is if you don't have billions, if you don't have millions, in fact, if you don't even have thousands, it's the hardest possible to try to work around this process. And Mr. Sanders,
so please join me in calling for a repeal of Buckley.
Pardon me? Yeah, now we're going to the political process.
No. Buckley v. Vallejo was a Supreme Court decision, and what it said was that you may buy a politician. Yeah, exactly. The rules of the game of economics. You can't talk about economics without talking about politics, Horace. You know this, because the rules of the game of economics are defined politically. Economies don't happen in a vacuum other than just, you know, the very smallest, you wash my car, I'll mow your lawn. I mean, you know, that's about as close as you can get to a free market. But there is no such thing as a free market. Marketplaces are created by governments. They provide the money. They provide the rules. They provide the courts for enforcing those rules. And increasingly, since the Buckley case in 1976, what we have said is that very wealthy people and very wealthy corporations can buy politicians who will then do things like extending copyright forever for the mouse, right, for Disney. And it wasn't forever, but, you know, absurdly.
You and I agree that that's a bad policy choice.
So let's repeal
The point I continue to make is this is envy masquerading as economics.
No, this is not envy. This looking at the American middle class being destroyed is not envy. It's a simple statement of fact.
Oh, yes, it is. Yes, it is. I can be concerned about the American middle class without being envious, but what I hear from you is all I want to see is these other people get their comeuppance.
Horace, I never said that, and your attempts to psychoanalyze me or figure out, you know, my emotional motivations are diminishing your argument. Make an argument based on the facts, not on your assumptions about what I may or may not be envious about.
That's the socialist mantra, and by the way, if you took me as saying you, this socialist mantra about making sure that those at the top, quote, pay their fair share, is envy masquerading as economics.
No, it's not envy. It worked really well. What was wrong with our economy in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s when the top tax rate, yes, you know, if you earned under $100,000 or under $200,000 or under $300,000, you're paying fairly low taxes. But after your second or third $1 million, you started hitting tax rates of 74%, 90% during the socialist Eisenhower administration. And Dwight Eisenhower not only supported that, he campaigned on it in 1956 for reelection and won.
In the 1950s, we were a much more labor-intensive community. There is
absolutely That's because our jobs
no way,
were still here.
There is absolutely no way that you're going to make the modern digital economy one that is labor-intensive.
Sure you can. It's not China just did it.
No, China isn't.
Germany is doing it.
The exact opposite.
Germany is absolutely doing it. And they're both, and then Japan is doing it, and Taiwan is doing it, and South Korea. South Korea, 1956, the average annual income of a South Korean was $535, and their major export was human hair. And Xi came in and said, no, we're going to build a modern industrial economy, and we're going to do it exclusively through protectionism. And that's what they did, and they continue to this day. All of these economies protect their domestic manufacturing. We didn't because we listened to conservatives like you.
Every single one of the countries that you outlined has had its biggest growth in the non-labor-intensive areas. Even if you want to tell me about the great things that they were able to do with protectionism that satisfied their political needs, what you can also see, and what the overwhelming majority of economists who look at this say, is that the real world global growth is in the non-labor-intensive areas, except for those emerging economies.
Well, if you're looking at those numbers, what you're looking at is the fire economy, and that's basically banksters. You're talking about all the banking activity that's going on, and yes, that overshadows pretty much everything else, and it shouldn't. Banking needs to go back to being a boring profession. Can we agree at least on that, Horace?
I think we can find a lot of areas of agreement. I just want more growth that gives people who want to wash your car an opportunity, who want to wash and mow my lawn an opportunity.
Okay. Horace Cooper, nationalcenter.org. Thank you, Horace.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back, 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. John in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I got with your previous caller, if he's so hot on the economics, why is the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement and all its chapters secret? But the main reason I'm calling you is it's about the Patriot Act, and everybody, all week, the news has been talking about it, and no one has mentioned to date that I've heard about the two secret interpretations that the government has used and that has been exposed by Snowden. Amy Goodman and Glenn Greenwald were talking this morning on their show, and there was no mention of these two secret agreements, and I wanted to get your comment on it, please.
John, I honestly don't know what you're talking about.
Well, in the Patriot Act, Section 215,
right.
It says if you want to do this, you got to do that, and that's the face value of how this secret law was written. But even beyond that, the government has two secret interpretations of the law that they're utilizing to get around any oversight or any...
Are you talking about the stuff that the second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals just ruled was illegal?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
In other words, we're the Bush administration and now the Obama administration both are using Section 215 in ways that, according to Jim Sensenbrenner, the Republican member of the House of Representatives who helped write the Patriot Act, was not the intent of the legislature. But you know, they didn't stay it, to the best of my knowledge. They just said it's illegal.
Well, yeah, and but if the House's version, what's it called, the Freedom Act, which really is not any improvement. Either way you look at the Patriot Act that they're contemplating, it doesn't change anything. And until we actually get these two secret interpretations, until we find out exactly what this is about, it's the same old, same old. Nothing's actually going to change at all. Even though the thing is sunset, right now, currently, the government is still doing exactly what they want, no matter what. And what are the rule of law for, and what are we all living under?
Yeah, I mean, here's the problem, John. This is the same thing. I was thinking about this morning about Vietnam. It's that Vietnam made a bunch of defense contractors really insanely rich. And you know, our Iraq war has made, I mean, you know, made Dick Cheney, at least made his company, you know, over $30 billion, a company that was near bankruptcy when he became vice president. And so now we have shifted from war being the most profitable thing to snooping, spying being the most profitable thing. So now there's this enormous amount of lobbying going on Capitol Hill. I mean, if it only cost $10,000 to buy a Republican congressman's vote for the TPP or the TPA for Fast Track, you know, what does it cost to buy their vote to keep spying going on? 15,000, 12,000, 6,000? I don't know. But it's a sad commentary. And yeah, I'm with you. We need to know more about this. John, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? Is Hobby Lobby a person? Hell no. How else can you say it, right? No, it's not a person. Nick in Columbus, Ohio, listening on Sirius. Hey, Nick, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Good to be on the show. I listened to it, and I was out and about, and I was listening to the guy talk, arguing economics and say we can't argue politics at the same time. And I guess what I'm getting at is I have friends that are these extreme libertarians.
Right.
Believe that when these, you know, like the banking crisis happens and the government can't prevent it from happening, the solution is then to dismantle the government.
Right, which is crazy. I mean, here's the simple reality. Economies are like football games. There are rules and there are ways to enforce those rules. And the question is, who gets to write the rules? And what the libertarians would have in this country is that the rules are written by billionaires and big corporations, and you know how they're going to write those rules, and increasingly have been since Reaganism took over, versus we the people via our elected representatives write the rules. Back to you, Nick.
Well, it's so dishonest what that man was arguing. It's almost as if we have fires in our city, and we have a fire department. Well, obviously, our fire department is not stopping fires, so we might as well dismantle. It's not doing its job. And that's, in fact, I mean, that's an extreme example, but that's what they're arguing. Yeah. Oh, get rid of the government. When the government is dismantled and can't do anything because it's not funded and it fails to prevent harm, the solution is dismantle it even more.
Yeah. This is a time-honored Republican strategy. It was laid out by David Stockman. He called it starve the beast, basically. And what you do is you cut funding to government programs that are working to the point where they no longer work. And then you say, hey, look at that. That school is failing. You know, that road isn't being maintained. That water system is not doing a good job. And so let's privatize it. Let's sell it off to a billionaire. And you know, this is a strategy that these guys have been doing for a long, long time. Nick, thanks a lot for the call. You're spot on. Laura in Riceville, Iowa. Hey, Laura, thanks for listening to Sirius. What's up? Laura? Laura's on line three. I don't think we're having problems with line three. Let me put her on hold, and we'll try Khalil. Khalil in Toledo, Ohio. Hey, Khalil, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Okay. Hey, okay. I'm calling because, first of all, I didn't know the thing about the unions and that you could, that the unions decided how the money was spent. So I learned something today.
Yeah, they do. And in fact, you can also tell your union, they have a separate fund for political activity, and it's part of your union dues, but you can tell your union, do not take that money out of my, you know, do not charge me for that. And your union dues go down slightly, and the union has a little less money to use for politics. But if you don't want your union, if you don't agree with what your union is doing with that money, first of all, you know, it gets decided by a 51% vote. If you're one of the 49%, you can simply say, don't take my money. And by law, the unions can't use your money for that particular political activity. And you know, I agree with you, Khalil. I think most Americans don't know that. Back to you.
Yeah. If you listen to right wing media, they never. I got brain rot listening to them.
Yeah.
I drive a truck, so that's all you can get. But what I called about originally was this guy out in Phoenix. You know, this guy is trying to raise $10 million to secure his home.
Oh, geez.
And he said, well, if I don't get whatever the $10 million is to secure my home, anything that goes over it, I'm going to donate to Children's Hospital, or he's going to run for John McCain's seat in the Senate there. So I just thought this guy has got to be the biggest huckster in,
yeah,
I don't know how long. Man.
Yeah, it's just like the Republican clown car is more than 50% made up of grifters. I think that Pamela Geller and this guy, John, whatever his name is, these people are grifters. You know, they're hustlers. There apparently is one woman who runs around and you know, where Muslims are speaking and goes into mosques and things and starts shouting about how she hates Islam and whatnot. She appears to be schizophrenic, you know, mentally ill. But I don't think these guys are mentally ill. I think they're just hustlers. And that's amazing. I'm not at all surprised that this guy is saying, oh, my God, you know, send me money now because I've spoken out against Islam and they're going to come and get me. I mean, I get death threats. I get hate mail. I'm not putting up a website that says, please donate money so that I can put security on my, you know, I can hire three bodyguards. I have no bodyguard. You know, what do you? It's nuts. It's nuts. Khalil, are you Muslim?
Yes, sir. 22 years as of April. I'm 22 years and 22 years married in May. Oh, yes.
Cool. What is your experience of being a Muslim in America right now, if you don't mind my asking?
Honestly, when I accepted Islam, there was a whole lot. It was the first World Trade Center stuff when I accepted Islam. So, you know, for me, it's come kind of full circle. Back then, you know, people didn't really care. You could drive around with your friends and not expect any guff. Nowadays, man, we wear traditional clothing sometimes, and, you know, people look at you strange. My wife completely covers. They don't think my wife can speak English.
Oh, jeez.
So they'll say stuff to her, and she's like, what did you just say to me? And so, you know, it's sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. I've lived in three or four different cities. I live in the Midwest. I was out on the East Coast. It's just different places. I drive a truck, so I had to pull over in these little small towns and stuff. And, you know, you get differing reactions of people. Most of the time, it's not a problem, but every once in a while, you get the idiot. But I'm going to chalk that up to people just being idiots and not to my religion. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
About them being upset about my religion. But this guy out here, man, I just thought he was a huckster, man. And I just really hope that these people see through this guy. And I just want to say one last thing. I got to make a delivery. Love your show. I'm back on Sirius again. And you know, you're one of my first favorites, man, and I learn a lot every time I listen to you. So thanks a lot. Keep doing what you do, please.
Well, thank you, Khalil. You too. And you know, keep living your life and spreading the word and being a great example of Islam that works in the United States. Thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from you. I mean, this is the new acceptable bigotry in the United States. I mean, we're almost to the point of the what was the decision, Shano, in 1898, that separate but equal, Plessy versus Ferguson. I mean, I'm waiting for some right-wing crazy to say we're going to create Muslim-free zones in America, or separate but equal, right? I mean, this is how insane we've got. We'll be back after the news.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Tom Hartman with you. We will be back. Stick around. It is 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where smart people get their news. And Laura in Riceville, Iowa. Hey, Laura.
Hey there.
Thanks for listening to the series.
I saw Bernie this weekend. I've never met him before. Really never paid a whole lot of attention to him. I do listen to him on your show. But in the small town of Kensett, Iowa, which has about a population of 269 people, there were 300 people there to see Bernie.
Wow.
More than the population of the town. We were hoping maybe we'd get 50. 50 is a big crowd for us, like in the tri-counties. Three of our counties are together
right.
for the Democrats. And we were hoping. We bought enough little hors d'oeuvres for about 50 people. And people just kept coming from Minnesota and Wisconsin and far, you know, 5 hours away in Iowa. And there was young people there and signs and standing ovations. It reminded me of the early days of Obama. I'm not kidding you. People
yeah.
were just absolutely crazy for him. And I'm so glad to see it. I was really impressed with him.
In the meantime, have you been to or do you have firsthand or even, you know, secondhand from somebody that you really trust knowledge of how in a town like yours, you know, a little town of fewer than 300 people, how Rick Santorum or Jeb Bush or Scott Walker or one of these Republicans, what kind of crowds they're drawing?
They don't come up here, Tom. I'm telling you, they don't get very close to us. They stick to the plan in Iowa for them. Generally, they might get close. They might say that they're in a little teeny town, but they stick close to Des Moines and Dubuque and Davenport, unless something's on the way somewhere else.
Right.
They don't bring crowds. They might have a house party, and it'll be a house party that's invitation only. I'm also the chair of the Howard County Democrats, so I know how things work around here. And they generally, they have house parties.
Which are really fundraisers, aren't they?
Yes, and it is. It's all the business owners in town and the big Republicans that live in the town that go to these events. And they're just, yeah, basically fundraisers.
Right.
And even, you know, Hillary Clinton doesn't. She has the same type of deal. Well, she's been here so far. She's had invitation only events in which she's had 40 people there. So, you know, she hasn't gone out yet and just had a town hall around here. So, yeah
it'll be interesting. I suspect Hillary will draw pretty good crowds, too. I think that there's a lot of enthusiasm on the Democratic side, period. I mean, people love Bernie because he's a radical truth teller. There is nobody that I know of who as transparent as Bernie. You know, no politician I've ever met.
He's got a wave of young people. My daughter, not particularly political, mm-hmm. is very excited by him. I think because I've been asking people that are young, I go up and ask every single one of them, like, what's bringing you to Bernie? What's bringing you here?
Right.
And they said, because he doesn't have a normal bullet.
Pardon me, you can't use that word on the air, Laura. I'm sorry, I got to drop your call. And we're gonna dump it. Kara in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I understand, but, you know, we just can't use language like that on the air. My apologies. I don't think it made it through. No, it might have on television. If so, my apologies. I hope you're not offended. Kara in Albuquerque, New Mexico, you are on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi,
I just wanted to make a comment with regard to your guest suggesting that we suffer from envy instead of actually suffering from unfair business practices.
Yes.
I am just sick to death of that argument. I mean, I was in the first.com era, made a very good living in New York City, went back to graduate school, got a master's degree in a very high-tech skill set, worked for the film industry as a visual effects artist. My job got shipped to Canada. I went back to doing programming, and I'm making exactly the same amount of money as I was in 2001.
Wow. And that's not an inflation-adjusted dollars.
No, exactly the same amount of money.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, and granted, I left an industry for a while and came back, but these are very high-tech industries, and it's all because of just shenanigans.
Yeah.
Business shenanigans.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. There is, and this is one, you know, and there have been no shortages. There's been no shortage of reporting on this by organizations like the Financial Times, that because companies are sitting on huge piles of cash, because banks are sitting on huge piles of cash, because rich people are sitting on huge piles of cash, there's not cash available to loan to small businesses and to the average person, and except at 28% rates on a credit card. And so, you know, once again, we all get screwed because of, as you said, bad business practices. It's a terrible thing. Kara, you nailed it. Thank you for the call. And thanks for listening to iHeartRadio. Don in Columbia, Mississippi. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My thanks to Danielle and my apologies. I was finally able to give her a topic that I really wanted to talk about.
Okay.
Over the weekend, I logged on to ChaunceyDeVega.com, and following some of the links, I came up on an article where John McCain, along with 54 other Congress members, had a bunch of money stashed and somewhere. I don't know if it was, I'm sure it was offshore somewhere, but it was something not available to, you know, John Q. Public like me.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, Apple's sitting on $100 billion overseas right now. That's money that could be in the United States stimulating the economy. And they're just unwilling to pay taxes on it, which is crazy because this country is what made Apple rich.
Absolutely. And, you know, my rant is, you know, listening to this guy that you had, your guest here a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
And
Horace.
You know, I worked in an industry for 40 years, almost, 38 years in the oil industry. And I'm talking about offshore.
Right.
I know what these oil companies do. I know how they skirt around safety. And all they talk about is regulations. And I'm amazed at how they can justify, keeping the middle class where they are and how good they are at making the middle class believe we're going down the right path.
I think people are starting to wake up. I think when Republicans, you know, when Scott Walker goes on in the media and says, oh, you know, ultrasound's no big deal, you know, shoving that wand up in there, you know, it's no big deal. It's a beautiful thing. You know, I think people are realizing, A, those are stupid talking points, these wedge issues of abortion and guns and God and gays and now, you know, Muslims and whatnot. I think, A, people are realizing it's fear-mongering and stupid politics. And, B, people are realizing we're being robbed blind and the Republican Party and conservatives don't want to discuss anything economic. Or if they do, they say that, you know, it's class envy. They don't want to discuss anything economic because that's all that matters to them. They're perfectly willing to you know, let Republicans talk about these, you know, crazy issues that don't cost anybody anything. But, you know, holy cow, if anybody was to come out and say, you know, maybe we should raise the tax rate back to where it was during the Eisenhower administration, as Bernie Sanders has said, you would just, you know, their heads explode. So, you know, Don, I'm with you. With regard to John McCain hiding tons of money, I have no idea. I can tell you, though, that his wife, he married into the, I believe it was the, not the Budweiser fortune, but her father was the largest, as I recall, Budweiser distributor in the state of Arizona, and she's worth millions, maybe over $100 million. And so John McCain married very well financially and has been riding that gravy train for a long, long time. Don, thanks for the call. Jack, in Lenoir City, Tennessee, is that it?
Lenoir City.
Great. What's up?
Enjoy Death in the Times.
Uh-huh.
Your book.
Oh, Death in the Pines. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Born in Detroit, 1933.
Wow.
Raised in Dearborn, Michigan. And at the time, there were there were no blacks in Dearborn. They did their best to keep the blacks out of Dearborn.
Right, and Henry Ford was doing his best to keep the Jews out also.
Well, sure. And the other thing that Ford did was drew labor from all over the world, except from the Orient. And our high school probably had 20% Arab community people.
Mm-hmm. You mean Muslim or you mean Arab? because there's a difference.
Just for the different Middle Eastern groups.
Right.
And the neighborhoods, my neighborhood, had Polish, Italian, Armenian.
Mm-hmm. So, Jack, what's your point?
The point is, back then, you never saw a burqa. Nobody was pushing pushing their agenda on us.
Well, I don't think a woman wearing a burqa is pushing her agenda on you. She's just wearing her burqa any more than I think that an Orthodox Jew who dresses in black and white and grows his locks, I forget the name of it, next to his ears, is trying to push anything on any of us.
They didn't even wear them back then.
Well, they did. They did. I mean, you might not have seen a lot of them, but they were there.
At school. The girls at school never wore them.
Yeah. Well,
my high school.
Yeah. I can't speak to that, Jack, but, you know, thanks for the call. It's just, you know, the back in the good old days when we had redlining and we had discrimination and we had, I mean, I was having this conversation with a friend of mine on the vocal board, Garland, over the weekend, and who's now living in Detroit. And he's African American, very, very smart guy. And he's like, I didn't even realize that it wasn't until the 60s that the laws were passed that said that the GI Bill would be eligible to African Americans. You know, that when the GI Bill was put into place in the 1940s, like my dad got a GI Bill loan, right, to buy a house. He was white. Had he been black, he would not have been able to get that loan. I mean, this is astonishing stuff. We have to be careful about nostalgia.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the economy did work quite well back in the 50s, 60s, back in that era, 40s even, largely for white middle class Americans. So let's make it work for everybody. And welcome back, Mark in Sacramento. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi, Tom. Hey, you know, as someone who kind of clings to some Christian values, I'm a little bit offended by Mr. Cooper's assertion that you and I are envious of the billionaire class.
Yeah, was Jesus envious?
It really bothers me, you know, it's our envy of the billionaire class that is what's wrong when Christian values would think that, you know, some of these socialistic principles of helping feeding hungry people most of the people that I know that are attacking socialism, they're receiving social security payments and they're maybe even a government pension and they're listening too much of Rush O'Hannity, you know, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's really offensive to be told that I'm envious of the billionaire class when really I'm just willing to pay my fair share and I don't see anything wrong with that.
Right. Right. And why shouldn't the billionaires too? I'm totally with you. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Howard, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania. Hey, Howard, do you want to talk about the TPP?
Yes, I do. You know, Tom, if you have a factory, and there's like 1,000 employees that have lost their job. Not only have you put those people on the street, the income taxes that they paid, their Social Security checks, money that they paid in, all that is lost because now that factory's in another country, and those employees don't pay into our system at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never heard you and Bernie talk about that.
Yeah, there's a huge knock-on effect. You know, when you shut down a factory where people are making, you know, $20, $30, $40 an hour, which is what we used to pay factory workers back in the day, when you shut down that factory, not only have you lost the jobs for those people, but those people then buy things in the community that support other local businesses. They're buying products, they're buying homes, they're buying cars, and that's providing jobs for other people. And so by moving the jobs to another country, we're not just moving the jobs and the revenue from the jobs. We're also even moving the profits to another company, another country. And, you know, so it's
value.
Yeah.
The thing that conservatives talk about.
Yeah, it's as Adam Smith referred to it, the wealth of nations. The wealth of nations comes about as a consequence of manufacturing. And as we have surrendered manufacturing since the Reagan era and shipped all our manufacturing overseas, we're down to about 11% manufacturing. And I don't know what the number would be if you took out military manufacturing, but I'm guessing that it would probably knock a couple more points off that. We're just basically not making anything in this country anymore that doesn't kill people. And it's so sad. I mean, you know, the pharmaceutical companies are relocating overseas. It's not a good thing. And that's the thing that, you know, I hope this conversation comes about around the discussion of the TPP as this thing is moving now to the House of Representatives. Howard, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Talk media for the sane among us, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. And Victoria, I see you are in the basement of the White House.
I am indeed. Yes, I just ducked out of the White House press briefing.
So what happened there?
Spokesman Josh Earnest urged the Senate quite forcefully to pass the USA Freedom Act, which, as you know, passed the House about a week ago, as the Senate last night did pass the USA Freedom Act in a procedural vote. Now, of course, as you know, the Senate last night let certain provisions of the Patriot Act lapse.
Mm-hmm.
This is the data collection, the phone records collection of the Patriot Act and some other provisions. And Josh Earnest was scolding the Senate for that, but he said they need to pass the USA Freedom Act as is without tinkering with it and messing about and adding amendments to it, which is what actually the Senate is looking to do right now. Because if they do that, of course, as you know, it'll have to go back to the House and get passed again.
Right. Although it probably would, wouldn't it? I mean, isn't...
Well, it passed overwhelmingly with 338 votes to 33. I don't think the House would be too pleased at having to do it again.
Yeah. But Boehner has that capability.
He does have that capability, but it would slow things down.
Yeah.
And Josh Earnest was at pains to point out that they feel, to get these provisions, which have lapsed, back in place very quickly. Because he wouldn't say that the USA is less safe without them. He said it was up to people to draw their own conclusions.
Right. Interesting.
French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius says that a possible nuclear deal with Iran risks sparkling a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. Now, what he's saying is that it's very important that the ability to inspect nuclear sites of military facilities and other secret facilities is in the deal. And it's also very important that the international inspectors from the IAEA also have access to the military as well.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that Ayatollah Khamenei has been saying is not going to happen. In fact, Khamenei said as recently as last week that that's not going to happen. And Fabius said in an interview with the Wall Street Journal, the best agreement, if you cannot verify it, it's useless. He's saying if you can't verify these Iranian military sites with the international inspectors, they could be building anything.
Yeah. Okay.
Very interesting decisions coming down from the Supreme Court today.
Tell me about them.
A ruling in a case testing the limits of free speech online. The Supreme Court said that a person cannot be convicted of making threats simply because others might regard the language as threatening.
In other words, you have to demonstrate that the intent of the threator, the person making the comment, was actually intending it to be a threat as opposed to a disagreement?
Well, what Chief Justice John Roberts said was that asking whether a, quote, reasonable person would have regarded the statements of this particular individual as threats was not enough to sustain a criminal conviction in a case. The case before the court involved, and you'll remember this now, Anthony Alonis, who was convicted of threatening his wife, a kindergarten class, police officers, and an FBI agent. He maintained that his graphic statements posted on Facebook were tongue-in-cheek remarks in the style often used by rap musicians. He said things like, "I'm not going to rest until your body is a mess, soaked in blood and dying from all the little cuts."
That sounds like a threat to me.
"There's one way to love you, but 1,000 ways to kill you."
That sounds like a threat to me.
That's what he said to his wife.
To his wife?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, exactly. Yes. "The jury was instructed," Roberts wrote, "that the government need prove only that a reasonable person would regard Alonis' communications as threats, and that was error. Federal criminal liability generally does not turn solely on the results of an act without considering the defendant's mental state." So
I thought when the defendant's mental state was involved, that was like adding malice, you know, like, you know, if somebody kills somebody accidentally, well, okay, that person is dead. There's one level of punishment for that. But if they do it in the heat of the moment, that's another level of crime. And if they plan it out for 3 weeks, that's the highest level of crime. That's first degree murder. So the intent, the intent of the person, but even at the lowest level, there can be, I mean, you know, a friend of mine's dad actually went to jail for hitting a kid and killing him, in a bad intersection where this had actually happened several times before. It was not his intent to do that, you know.
Well, what they've done is that they declined to say how much proof should be required in these cases, so they've left it to lower courts to make new decisions on whether recklessness would be sufficient to convict someone or whether prosecutors would have to show that someone intended to provoke fear.
Interesting.
It's a narrow ruling, but it's profound. They also ruled against Abercrombie and Fitch, the retailer, 8-1. Deciding that the company's failure to accommodate a job applicant who wore a hijab violated civil rights law.
Wow. I read in your newsletter today about the woman wearing a hijab on the United flight who wanted to open her own can of Coke.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Yes.
It's amazing. And then she turns to the people around her and says, you know, "Am I being discriminated against?" And some guy goes off on a rant about her using the F word. It's America. We have been so frightened by the Cheney. Well, don't get me started. Any back to you on the news.
Hillary Clinton will officially launch her presidential campaign with a 13th of June speech honoring two Democratic Party icons, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. The location: Roosevelt Island in the middle of the East River in New York City.
Wow. That's perfect. I mean, I don't know about Roosevelt Island, but, you know, Franklin and Eleanor, if you want to get Democrats thinking fondly of you, just talk about them.
That's what she's going to do.
Yeah, and probably with some considerable success. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. We'll be back. It's coming up on the top of the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Here's how it works, right? Here's how the media works. It's called synergy. I was watching Thomas Roberts here on MSNBC, and although I have the sound off, so, you know, I'm just telling you what I'm seeing. And I'm seeing this clip of Bernie Sanders on Meet the Press. And I thought, oh, cool, they're talking about Bernie on Meet the Press. And then immediately they segue to 50 Shades of Grey and scenes from the movie and a discussion about the movie. And I thought, oh, I can't believe this. So they took Sanders, I'm guessing, again, I didn't hear the sound, but it's the only thing that makes any sense. They took Bernie's talking about how his 43 year ago, 20 or 30 paragraph short story that was about the gender stereotypes and things. They took that and turn and you know, Bernie said it was like a badly written version of 50 Shades of Grey. They took that and turned it into an opportunity to discuss the movie. Now, why would they do that? Well, because the movie was distributed by Universal, which is owned by NBC. I mean, I don't want to call it a mistake, but I mean, you know, I doubt that Bernie knew the 50 Shades of Grey was owned by NBC or owned by Universal, which owns NBC, or vice versa. And that therefore, by simply mentioning that on the air, he would provide them with weeks of opportunity to promote stuff that will make money for them, because the media today is not about information. They don't care what the issues are. They want to make money. They want advertising dollars, and, you know, in the case of NBC Universal, I mean, this is what's referred to as synergy. And synergy is where you use one product to promote another product when you own them both. And especially effective if people don't realize that you own them both. So, anyway, I found the whole thing fascinating. Rafiq in Humble, Texas. Hey, Rafiq, you wanted to get back to this Muslim woman on the plane who the flight attendant would not give an unopened can of diet soda to?
Yes, Tom, and great show as usual.
Thank you.
And I have to say that that guy Harris is just a straight buffoon.
Well, you know, he works for a conservative think tank. They've got their line.
Understood. Yeah, I'm pretty well versed in Islam. I have family members that was also raised in it, and I also fly on United regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard you mention that the gentleman was given a beer, he was given a beer because he purchased it, so they don't normally open the can of beer or whatever unless it's requested for. As far as the regular beverages that are given complimentary,
mm-hmm.
they open and they kind of split them with other
right.
passengers. In
a sense, at least on the commuter airlines in particular, you get a cup with a half a can of Coke in it and a little bit of ice. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, and they do it also to save money, because I remember before you used to just get your own can.
Right.
So because of the budget cuts, they did it. So it may not necessarily be the stewardess was being prejudiced.
No, she actually said, I can't give it to you because you might use it as a weapon. That's what she said to this woman.
That was wrong, and I guess I was also focusing on what the gentleman said. Now, what the gentleman said was definitely out of place, but if the stewardess said that to the passenger, that was definitely
out of place. Yeah, she said to a woman wearing a hijab, I cannot give you an unopened can of Diet Coke because you might use it as a weapon on this airplane.
I know policy, and that's crossing the line.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's really seriously crossing the line, and I have a feeling that flight attendant might be looking for another job or, going through some sort of retraining or something. I mean, but then another passenger starts yelling at this woman in the hijab that she's, you know, using the F word repeatedly, and I mean, this is, like I said, this is the new acceptable discrimination in the United States. This is and it's wrong. It is so, so terribly wrong. Rafiq, thanks a lot for the call. I know exactly what you're talking about, and I had hoped that that was the case. But when I, you know, in Victoria's News, when I read that the flight attendant actually told this woman that she couldn't give her an unopened can because it could be used as a weapon, and, you know, I thought, you know, and how is that different than a can of beer that was paid for that couldn't all, you know, what are you going to do, shake it enough to, you know, or bean somebody over the head with it, I guess? I just, you know, it's bizarre. Rafiq, thanks for the call. Eddie, in Copperas Cove, Texas. Do I have that right?
Yep, that's correct. Copperas Cove, Texas. How are
what's
you?
Up?
I've got a quick question. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Your stance, or one of your stances, is that corporations have a social obligation. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so if they have a social obligation...
No, wait, hang on just a second. Let me clarify it. We, you and me, the people... We established rules that give benefits to people when they incorporate. When I incorporated this program, I now have the opportunity to take Shane and Danielle out to lunch, and guess who's going to pay for that lunch? You, through your tax dollars, because it's tax deductible, as long as we're talking about business. So, and there's 1,000 other benefits that you get from incorporating. So in exchange for those benefits, all we're asking is that corporations operate at least neutral to the public, but ideally in some small way to the public good, like, you know, hiring people appropriately, paying people reasonably, not mistreating their customers or their employees, that kind of thing. That's the logic, Eddie. It was in law in the United States up until the 1890s. Back to you.
Okay, but the bottom line, Tom, is that you're you know, to use a literary comparison, you're using personification on a corporation in as much as its social obligation.
No, I'm using the personification on the management of the corporation. The corporation has to be managed in a way that does not harm the public.
Okay, but if you have to transpose a moral compass in as much as social obligation is
This isn't a moral compass, Eddie. This is a quid pro quo. This is not a moral compass. This is a quid pro quo. This is we the people, we the government, will give you benefits in order to make it easier and more profitable for you to do business. In exchange for that, we want you to do no harm. That's not a moral argument. That is an appropriate to society argument. That's a quid pro quo. It's an exchange.
Tom, that's a very hypocritical stance. If you demand a social obligation from a corporation, you are personifying that corporation, and thus you cannot separate a social obligation from a religious right. You can't.
That's nonsense. That's absolutely nonsense. First of all, I'm not talking about religion at all. Just set that aside. I'm talking about don't poison your community, right? And what we know from hundreds of years of experience with capitalism is that when capitalism is completely unregulated, communities get poisoned routinely. Workers get poisoned and killed and even shot at if they try to unionize routinely. All over the world. I mean, you got slave labor in Malaysia right now that might be screwing up the TPP. That's the profit motive. So if somebody's going to engage in business for the profit motive, at least here in the United States and in most of the developed world, what we have said is, in exchange for that, we want you to behave well. That's got nothing to do with religion. It has nothing to do, frankly, with morality. It has to do with the reason why governments are instituted among men, to paraphrase or to actually quote the Declaration of Independence, to ensure their life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And one of the things that governments do is they create the playing field of the marketplace.
Well, to use your same logic, whenever you find an argument that you really can't overcome, you just qualify it as you qualify it as nonsense.
That's not the case either. I thought I made a very cogent and clear case. I haven't heard one from you, Eddie, but we're hitting a break here. You'll have to call back and we can debate this. We will live to debate it another day. Thanks for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I think, you know, it's extraordinary how many people don't understand what a business is, how business runs, how they came about, the history of them. Welcome back. Jesse in Miami, Florida, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Jesse, how you doing? What's up?
Hi, Tom. Wow, very, very interesting. Morality.
Yeah.
I think you can't do nothing without touching morality. But the main point, connecting business, and pretty much what you're talking about, how business gets started.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to try to put this question in this context. You talk about George Washington wanted to dress in at his inauguration in American-made clothes.
Right.
Would he ever imagine that the clothes maker would be his descendants would be ruling the world right now?
And that they would be making those clothes in China or Malaysia or Vietnam.
Right. Okay. The main point I want to make is this: money. Mm-hmm. Money seems to be everything. It's the love of money is the root of evil.
Yes.
Okay. Money is compromising our vote, our political politics.
Yep.
So what would be the most effective way to use the money that we do, you know, our little 2 cent? What would be the most effective way to use our 2 cent to win back the power of our vote? Stop using our money from compromising our power. That's basically it.
I would say it would be making a small contribution to a group that's working very, very hard to overturn Citizens United and blow up this concept that corporations are people and that money is speech. MoveToAmend.org is my favorite among all those organizations, and they're actually in charge of basically a coalition of dozens, maybe hundreds of other organizations. The Washington branch of Move to
Amend. What do you think about this? 99% credit union. 99% credit union.
What do you mean?
You say donate your money to a political group. I would say donate money to, say, Ralph Nader said he's going to start a crowdfunding for a 99% credit union.
Oh.
People's
public. Well, every credit union is for the 99%, ideally. I mean,
Not really. They as much.
Well, yeah, they'll take money from a billionaire, too, I'm sure, but. And maybe, actually, I don't know, because credit unions are democratic institutions. And if you have an enormous... Go ahead.
The union is really compromised pretty much as our politics. Once you get a person in power, they brought out. Look at FIFA. They making a big deal about arresting people who took bribes, and they ain't arresting nobody who offered a bribe. So we got things kind of backwards. So when I'm saying credit union, it's pretty much like a figure of speech. It's pretty much the credit unions as they are now, they really run by the big banks. They just little baby brothers and sisters.
I don't think
but
so.
I'm talking about a credit union really pretty much like a cooperative.
Yeah. Well, that's what credit unions are, Jesse. I mean, it varies from state to state. They're governed by state laws as well as federal laws. But I used to, when I lived in Portland, I had an account with Unitas, which is a very, very good credit union. And it's completely transparent in their operations. You get their accounting. You know how much the CEO makes, everything. I mean, they're virtually democracies. So, but that's not giving your money away. That's basically credit unions perform the functions of banks. So that's just saving your money. So it's kind of a different question. But if you have money, a socially responsible way to keep that money is in a credit union. I agree with that. Jesse, thanks for the call. It's also a good way to avoid, any of those big banks getting in trouble, which I think someday they will. We'll be back.
Look, up in the sky.
It's a bird.
No, it's a plane.
We are autonomous robotic organisms from the planet Xenu.
And now, a story about a bird.
Yes, it's our pigeon alert for the day. Indian police, this is from the Associated Press. Ben Hooper, UPI. Ben Hooper writing for UPI. Indian police say they have detained a pigeon suspected of being a Pakistani spy. A 14-year-old boy in Manwal, a village close to the Pakistani border, brought the pigeon to a police station when he noticed that it had a stamped message on its wing feathers written in Urdu, which is the official language of Pakistan, and a Pakistani phone number. And the pigeon's feathers also reportedly bore the seal of a Pakistani district in Pakistan's Punjab province. They wrote it up as a suspected spy and x-rayed it. Amazing. Somebody needs to tell them they're all spies, right? Not just that pigeon; they're all spies. They're sent here from the planet Xenu to figure out what we're up to. It's why whenever there's meetings of powerful, wealthy people, there's lots and lots of pigeons. I mean, haven't you noticed? And you never see a baby pigeon, you never see a dead pigeon. They're robots. They're robotic spies. Patrick in Evansville, Indiana. Hey, Patrick, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Tom, I got to say, I have learned so much listening to your program, and there's one thing that before I get started, I wanted to say, you had said years ago that capitalism abhors a vacuum, and I have never forgotten that. And everything that I think and say to people, I always have that in the back of my mind. But the reason I called, I live in Indiana, and I wanted to say something about the RFRA law that was passed here. And, it seems that...
The supposed religious freedom law. Yeah.
People want to conflate capitalism, democracy, and religion. They want to kind of put them all together, and really, I kind of consider them maybe not mutually exclusive, but they certainly should remain independent of one another. And just like capitalism, you know, it's a matter of, you know, getting a license. You talk about this all the time. You know, there are rules. You get a license, you do business. You know, there are codes that you have to adhere to. When you start inserting religious beliefs into that capitalistic structure, you know, what's the difference between that and Sharia law, which people on the far right want to rail against? I don't see the difference of the two.
Yeah. Yeah. We really need to separate in our body politic, in our conversations, the whole thing, religion, capitalism, and democracy. I mean, they're very different things. And, yeah, excellent point, Patrick. Thank you for the call, and then thank you for making it. Robert in Bullhead City, Arizona. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Just talking about bringing industry back into this country. Each and every state at one time, marijuana used to grow indigenously.
Sure.
And
it's
my
weed.
Point being is...
Literally.
Yes, sir. And my point being is that every state has the right to legalize marijuana. And by doing that, it's not just to get people high. There's many medicinal uses for it. Mm-hmm. And we all know this.
Yep.
But there's also the industry factor. In every state, the materials that could be used from hemp is just incredible, all the industry that it could bring and all the revenue. Now, the federal government doesn't recognize this plant as such. They recognize it as one of the most dangerous drugs in America.
Mm-hmm.
It's a class one. It's just amazing how you talked about reefer madness.
Mm-hmm.
And my topic was this today. I've been waiting over an hour and a half. But my point being is every state, if you'll wake up, you can actually help yourselves first. And if the federal government does not want to join in, well, that's their problem. The Supreme Court has already ruled that the federal government cannot step in on any state that the people have voted marijuana into.
Right.
Now, that industry is open. Wake up, America, and let's get going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you, Robert. It's there's a rather alarming piece over on Alternet about how Washington State and Oregon are trying to crack down on medical marijuana and medical marijuana patients, and just, you know, how bizarre the whole thing has gotten. And it's more of a strong argument for just totally criminalization and for good medical research on this stuff. Thank you, Robert, for the call. Marcia in Angier, North Carolina. Hey, Marcia, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I have an announcement. Don't let me forget it before I get off the phone. But in reference to the Horaces of the world, I think that I'm just tired of arguing with them, trying to convince them, you know, to go back to the taxes the way they, you know, were. You talk about the Eisenhower years or before Reagan, or to convince them that the business model that they have is harmful to us. I think that we need to own our labor. We need to form cooperatives. It's not going to happen overnight, but it's a business. It's something we need to get busy doing before nobody has any work. They're cutting people's hours back because they don't want to pay for the health care. And it's the only way we can own our labor. I'm even feeling like unions might not be strong enough anymore.
Yeah.
Because you're still trying to negotiate with the owner.
Marcia, there are actually more people in the United States right now who work in worker-owned cooperatives than there are members of unions. So you're right.
Awesome.
That direction.
We need to do more of that. We need to meet together. I meet together when, you know, you go to protests and you talk to people, and they all, and a lot of them, they're like, "Well, I have a job. I'm not worried about that." And I'm like, "Really? You think you're separate from the rest of us? That your job is, you know, you're a doctor or you're you know,
right,
professional?" And anyway, everybody, there's a march for healthcare August 1st.
You need to go to healthcarejusticemarch.org, and we need to contribute because she's doing so much work to get this.
Thanks, Marcia. We're out of time. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Back with more of the news of the day, my thoughts on it, and your thoughts on it, right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 28 minutes before the hour. Well, this is interesting. James in Easton, Pennsylvania. Hey, James, what's on your mind?
Hi, it's a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you.
You wanted to talk about the flight attendant who told the woman in the hijab that she couldn't give her a closed can of Coke because she might use it as a weapon?
Right. So I don't want to argue with you. I know there's plenty of unfounded hatred out there. But I also wanted to suggest that, you know, among people I know, especially atheists or just spiritual, non-religious people, there's a sense of just we're kind of tired of all this religious stuff.
Do Orthodox Jews offend you, James?
I'll tell you what, my brother was unfortunately had to have heart surgery, and he was lucky enough to be in a New York City hospital, and I found it, like, utterly silly and ridiculous that on Saturdays there had to be special elevators set up for people that couldn't touch a button. I mean, it's time to grow up. It's 2015.
I think it's time to be tolerant of people's religious standards and beliefs. What's wrong with that?
Who's the one that's really inflexible here? I mean, the people that aren't willing to push a button or... You know, I've never seen a flight service where they don't open up every can of soda. Like, everyone knows that. It's time to be flexible.
I'm sorry. If the flight attendant had simply said, "I'm sorry, I have to open the bottles. It's just the airline's policy," that would have been no deal. That would have been no problem. But here is the exact. This is what she said, and I'm quoting from Victoria Jones's newsletter this morning. The flight attendant then opened a can of beer and said, "We are unauthorized to give unopened cans to people because they may use it as a weapon on the plane." And then a man sitting close to her, to this Muslim woman, said, "You Muslim, you need to shut the F up. Yes, you know you would use it as a weapon, so shut the F up." Really?
That's outrageous.
Yeah, I mean, I that is outrageous, and that's my point is that I get it. We can't do everything to accommodate everybody's religious needs and whatnot. And there's actually a fairly vigorous debate about this that happened in France where they banned the hijab, and that has happened here where, you know, can you take your picture with or without and these kind of things. And when you get into the really, really obscuring stuff, you know, where a woman is wearing a burqa, basically, and all you can see are her eyes, I think you can make a strong argument that, you know, that's not appropriate for a driver's license picture. But so there has to be some give and take between religion and society. I don't disagree with that concept. But what happened on this plane was wrong. And beyond that, it's emblematic of a hysteria, an anger, a hatred. I mean, look at what happened in Phoenix this weekend. Look at what Pam Geller's trying to do and trying to buy these, you know, hateful ads on buses here in Washington, D.C. The city just said, screw it. We're not taking any ads that are issue ads, period. So no more, you know, stop the TPP ads or anything because she wanted to put one up that says, you know, Islam kills Jews or something. And I'm over it. I am over this whole idea that we have to be afraid of people or hateful of people because of the way they practice their religion. There's over a billion Muslims in the world. Only 18% of them are in the Middle East or are Arab, excuse me. And of them, you know, I mean, Osama bin Laden had maybe 5,000 people with him, you know, maybe, you know, a hardcore of a couple hundred. And out of this, we have demonized an entire religion. England didn't do this with Catholicism during the, during the Troubles, you know, when the Irish Republican Army, which was entirely Catholic, was blowing up Protestant England, when damn near killed Maggie Thatcher. They blew up the building next to number 10 Downing Street, as I recall. And people weren't going, oh, it's those damn Catholics. No, it was, you know, there were issues there. And I think the same thing is happening in the Middle East. We blow up the Middle East. We destroy their government. We destroy their cultural artifacts. We ruin their economy. We poison their children. And we kill their civilians. We create 5 million refugees just in Iraq, not to mention hundreds of thousands of dead people. And you wonder, you know, and we sit around as Americans going, gee, I wonder why they're upset with us. And which is a whole separate rant from the rant that I originally started with. But James, you know, thanks for the call. It is a complex issue. Kathy in Etna, Wyoming. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Kiddingly, I received my White House letter. I mean, that's not kiddingly, but Ralph Nader might be jealous because I did actually get my letter from President Obama.
Oh, really?
Yes, sir. I sent him a quick little letter just begging him, and those were the words I chose, begging him not to pursue TPA, TPP, or the TTIP.
Right.
So I got my response back, a two-page letter, and one of the more interesting things, there's a lot of spin in here, I think, from the people I've been listening to for a couple of years now. But one of the interesting things that I thought you might be interested in is it says, while they have not yet finalized the TPP, the current agreement is available for all members of Congress to read and review. And they've conducted over 1,700 regular briefings with members of Congress on the status of negotiations and have provided full similar briefings for labor groups, environmental groups, and other interested parties. I must say, I've not heard anything from labor groups, environmental groups, or interested parties on this, other than they can't see anything.
Right. Probably the full briefings that they're providing are, trust us, everything's going to be wonderful.
And that's just kind of disappointing.
I mean, that's we've had members of Congress on this program saying that's basically the briefing we got was, trust us, it's going to be wonderful. If you want to look at it, by the way, in the room, you can't take notes. And, you know, you heard Barbara Boxer going off on that.
Hmm.
Yeah. So interesting. Very interesting. So the White House is spending it. I'm not surprised. I mean, you know, they want to get this thing passed and they know that the American people don't like it. Kathy, thank you for the call. Alan in Glendale, California. Hey, Alan.
Yes, Tom. I'm getting a little tired of this union bashing. It seems to me what the media has done and some of these corporations have done is to basically pit workers against workers.
Right.
So now workers feel that if you have certain protections, that you're almost taking advantage of the system.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, I'm sure most of these people, if given the option, would like some worker protections.
Right.
Instead, you know, at many workplaces, they can fire you without just cause. You don't have necessarily a due process system to go through. It's actually a shameful thing that that Americans often look at their other workers who have, I think, in many ways, very similar values to themselves, and get into this sort of cat fight against them rather than looking more deeply into the actual issues that are facing the country.
Well, there's a very understandable reason for this, Alan, and that is that unions typically, when unions vote to use their political money, to use their, you know, union dues for political purposes, they typically do it in support of Democrats. And this is why there has been a 35-year, well, actually, you can take it back to 1947 with Taft-Hartley. This is why there's been a 60- or 70-year Republican war on organized labor, on unions in the United States. It's real simple. They're trying to defund the Democratic Party, and they've been, by the way, very successful at doing that. Unions have gone from, you know, a third of our workforce down to 11%. So, anyhow, Alan, thank you for the call. Gary in Lakewood, Washington. Hey, Gary.
Off the wall. Mm-hmm, but
Gary, you are on the air.
Ready to get it.
Gary is not listening to his telephone. Denise in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Denise, what's up? Denise, can you hear me? Okay, that's line 10. We'll see what happens with line 7. Terry in Pahrump, Nevada. Hey, Terry, can you hear me? Terry can't hear me? Well, that's interesting. Put Terry on hold. Let's try Joe on line 8 in Guilford, New Hampshire. Hey, Joe.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, great. What's up?
Basically, we have a few major problems in our country. I would say the first major problem is that the majority of our citizens don't pay attention. So many people don't vote.
Well, hang on just a second, Joe. People are paying attention. What they're paying attention to, though, is infotainment. They're not, you know, there are not good sources, easily available sources, ubiquitous sources of genuine, detailed information about politics and economics so that the average American can make an informed political decision.
No, you're absolutely right, and that's what I'm getting at. They come home with their six-packs, and they sit in front of the TV, and they watch Two and a Half Men or Dancing with the Stars, and the things that are really important that affect their lives, they pay no attention to, but they're the first to complain about the fact that there's no representation for the average American. And I consider myself the average American. I'm a single parent with a handicapped son. I'm a carpenter. I'm 72 years old, and I haven't paid my mortgage for 4 years.
Wow.
I went to court pro se, and over the last 3.5 years, I've discovered not only is our government fraudulent, but our judicial system is fraudulent as well. You know, having the Supreme Court say that a corporation has the rights as an individual,
yeah,
there's so much...
Joe, I'm with you. I'm with you. As Elizabeth Warren says, the system is rigged.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Let's try that again. As Elizabeth Warren has said, the system is rigged, and it really is, top to bottom. We'll be back. And welcome back. Linda, watching Free Speech TV in Belmont, Illinois. Hey, Linda. Thank you.
Hey, Tom. How are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I hope so. This is concerning the tolerance and diversity. I grew up here in southern Illinois and moved away, and since then I've lived all over the United States from Miami to Portland, Oregon. And I raised my daughter that way, too, and moved back here and to be closer to my parents, which turned out bad because they died. But I got here and I was like, something's wrong. I don't know what it is. I can't figure it out, but something's wrong. And then it finally dawned on me, there's nobody else here. Everybody's the same. Everybody's white, little cookie cutters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And even our ball teams in the high schools and stuff, they're all white kids. And it's just, you miss that, and you don't hear any other languages. You don't see, there's a few black people that go to the community college out here, but I don't like that. And people don't realize that if you don't have that, if something's missing in your life, it doesn't broaden your sense of other people. And I think that they're missing out. I really do. And I don't like it here for that reason. My husband had to go to the hospital over in Evansville, Illinois. I noticed that guy called in from Evansville. And there was a man speaking a different language, and I just wanted to run up to him and hug his neck. I mean, I just don't like it here for that reason, and I don't understand. And it's like they don't have anybody to be prejudiced against, so they're prejudiced against one another. You got the big male-female thing going on. They got the mentality of, like, in the 50s where, you know, if you talk to somebody, you're obviously wanting to have an affair with them, you know. And I'm used to having friends, all different kinds of friends, male, female. You know, my little best friend was an Indian girl. I just lowered it up. I still talk to her. But people don't realize what they miss out when they don't have an open mind to other things, you know, and I just don't understand it at all.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I think one of the problems is that in our schools, you know, like in Holland, for example, I'm pretty sure you have to speak 4 languages before you can graduate from high school. In Germany, I know from, at least this was in the 80s when we lived there, our oldest daughter was in high school, and she had to speak 3 languages to graduate from high school. When you learn other countries' languages, you learn about their cultures as well. And we've got this xenophobia in the United States, this, you know, the kind of English only, just us, you know, many of the people, you know, the Republicans in particular, who have run, you know, saying, well, Pat Buchanan writing about how as America gets darker and darker, you know, right now a majority of babies being born in the United States are not white. And that's destroying this country. It's like, what? Wait a minute. You know, we should, you know, our ideal was to be the great melting pot. Yeah, we committed genocide against the Indians and enslaved African Americans or Africans and brought them to the United States. But the ideal was the melting pot. And we've gotten closer and closer and closer to that. And, you know, I would say to the people who say, you know, we need free trade agreements so we can help the rest of the world. We need to understand the rest of the world better. And that starts in our schools. Linda, thank you for the call. Thanks for your sentiment. It was much needed. Appreciate it. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. And check out the Bernie Bear, huh? We'll be right back. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Denise in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Denise, what's up? Denise? It's that dreaded line 7 thing. Okay, let's try Mark on line 1. Hey, Mark, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me, Tom?
Yes, sir. Just fine. What's up?
All right. Well, you can call me cynical, but I got a different take on this Republican war on women.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 57, and most of my life I've been led to believe that the easiest way to be put into poverty is to be a single mother, correct?
That meme, that theory is certainly out there, yeah.
Okay. So by eliminating abortion, eliminating birth control, what are the Republicans doing?
They're creating more single mothers. You're absolutely right. And, in fact, what you find is in the red states where they have those kind of rules or just that kind of mentality, they have a much higher level of out-of-wedlock births than they do in blue states where sex ed is taught in the schools and where birth control is widely and easily available.
I think it's just another mechanism for them to keep people locked into their socioeconomic standard.
Hmm. Interesting. It makes sense. I mean, locking women down by having policy that increases the probability of unintended pregnancies out of wedlock is certainly a way to keep women, you know, to assert and exert power over women, as well as to I guess that would be it, yeah. And then they call it religious, right?
I don't agree with it, but you can almost understand the logic against abortion. People have a moral objection to that. I cannot see any logic behind making birth control rough.
Yeah, I'm with you, Mark. I'm absolutely with you. Thank you for the call. Terry in Pahrump, Nevada. Hey, Terry, let's try it again.
Hey, how are you today?
Good. What's up?
Well, you know, brain exploding with lots of things from all the callers, but I'm going to keep the one subject today. You mentioned earlier Senator McCain married well.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to the finances, you're absolutely correct. But here's a few little tidbits of history about the Hensley family, which is her maiden name and the name of the distributorship that you were looking for.
Right.
Excuse me.
Beer distributorship in Arizona, yeah.
Right. Now, Mr. Hensley, a decorated war hero, I'll give him that, during World War II, but the first thing he did when he got out of the war was convicted of illegal alcohol distribution.
Oh, really? He was a bootlegger?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a felony offense in Arizona. Huh. He worked, however, for a man named Kemper Marley, which would be the redneck cowboy version of a godfather.
Uh-huh.
In Arizona. Incredibly wealthy man, and the people that are going to disagree with me are going to point out that Mr. Hensley and Mr. Marley have donated lots of money.
Right.
But in 1955, while working for Kemper Marley, Mr. Hensley and a bunch of his friends were indicted on this case about who really owned horse racetracks and where the skimming was actually going to.
Hmm.
Really interesting part of that was Mr. Hensley was represented by William Rehnquist.
Whoa. who ultimately became Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Exactly. Now, right after that, or right about that time, Mr. Hensley applied for a distributorship license, but by Arizona law would have been denied because of his felony conviction.
Right.
But as I said, Mr. Marley was the closest thing to the Don that we have in or had at that point in Arizona, and somehow managed to convince the liquor board to give Mr. Hensley the license so that he could go into his business. And, you know, obviously he was supported in the beginning by Mr. Marley, you know, to help him out, got things going. Mr. Hensley did ultimately turn into a very wealthy man. Now, what's interesting about this whole thing is I'm sure you remember an incident in 1976 in Arizona where a brilliant reporter named Don Bowles was blown up in his car in front of a hotel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kemper Marley was implicated in by the people that were hired to hire the hitmen.
Huh. It gets weirder and weirder.
And of course,
do you have a source for this, Terry, that people can fact check?
Well, sure, it's all on Wikipedia. You just look up. You can look up Mr. Hensley, and it gives all of his legal problems. There, you know, it's public information. It can't be hidden. And then don't forget, after that, after the Don Bowles thing, came Mr. McCain being a huge supporter of one Charles Keating.
Hmm.
So when you mention he married well, again, financially he did.
Right.
The Hensley family is, that's not marrying well.
Yeah. Okay. They're, all right, I stand corrected. He married rich. He married very rich. Terry, thanks for the call. I can't verify the veracity of anything that Terry said, but, you know, it sounds credible. Denise in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Denise, what's up?
Can you hear me now?
I do.
Oh, good. I'm concerned about the Enbridge pipelines that run from Western Canada to Eastern Canada via the Great Lakes states.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kalamazoo spill was from a pipeline veering off from the straits, and they had a spill in Crystal Falls that's veering off that runs along Lake Michigan, and they're increasing the capacity of that pipeline. It was finished in 1953.
Mm-hmm.
Attorney Bill Schutte was talking about it on the Ryan Report, which is a local station up here. I think we need calls to our congressmen and senators to just stop using this pipeline. My God, it's the Great Lakes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To turn into Alaska or the California shoreline.
Is regular oil going through that pipeline, or are they running tar sand slurry stuff?
They're trying to say that they're not running tar sand slurry stuff. But they're increasing the capacity of oil, and it's coming from Western Canada, and they're really not allowed to say on the websites I've been looking. But just the fact that they're increasing the capacity two or threefold since those spills is scary enough with them being finished in 53.
Yeah, yeah, amazing. Thank you, Denise. Audrey wanted to correct me that the political funds labor unions collect are separate from their dues. You're absolutely right, Audrey. And I'm sorry I don't have time to put you on the air because we're out of time. It's the end of the show. But you're absolutely right. And you can choose to opt out of those political funds. Thanks so much for being with us today. And, you know, so tomorrow, same time, same place. And don't forget, in the meantime, democracy requires you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. I'll see you later.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.